Hey everybody, good evening, Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Welcome to tonight's program. I hope the television networks, especially the cable networks, are not going to start this now where it says day one, and tomorrow be day two, and day three of the Obama presidency. There's something about television news and talk television that can take any issue and totally infantilize it. Have you noticed that? Yeah, me too. We'll continue our long goodbye to Pickles tonight, Laura Pickles Bush, by revisiting her speech to the Hurricane Katrina refugees who were shipped to a West Texas shelter following the disaster. And by disaster, I mean the way her husband handled that natural catastrophe. I watched some television this morning. Molly went to preschool, and Kathy took off and went to the Y. And so I was home making beds and watching the upstairs TV and kind of paying half attention. And then it went live to coverage of the National Prayer Service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., Interfaith Prayer Service that apparently has it dates all the way back to Washington, I think. And I'm kind of half paying attention and making the beds and kind of putzing around like you do. And I have to say it was pretty impressive. You know, for somebody who gave up on the religion thing a long time ago, I finally just, stopped folding clothes and sat down on the bed to watch. And I'll tell you, it was almost like being back in church back when I was a kid, used to go with my grandparents, very reminiscent. It was a truly ecumenical service, and I think that's what made it impressive. Yeah, very seldom do you see officers of these various churches, whether they're rabbis or priests or imams or bishops, whatever they are. Very seldom do you see them get together without a sense of, very seldom do I see them get together without a clear sense that they would all rather be someplace else, or at least among their own. It's, it's difficult. I'm sure it is difficult for a Catholic bishop and a Jewish rabbi to put forward a face of ecumenism, like, well, we worship the same God. Imagine how hard it is for a Muslim imam and a Jewish rabbi, or a Catholic bishop and a an Anglican an Anglican priest. These are religions who have fought each other tooth and nail for centuries, if not millennia. So it's something to watch. It was very impressive to me to see all these religious figures playing nice, and I'm not trying to be a smartass with that or be sarcastic. They were playing nice, and they were all talking about God, except the ones who also were talking about Jesus. But it was interesting to see just about every religion that has a presence in the U.S. represented on not the stage, but in the, in the front of the church, except Wicca. And I found that kind of interesting because Wicca is the only religion that is truly earth-centered. All the rest are based on one unifying element, I think, and that's a fear of death. All these religions are based on that fear of the complete ending of human consciousness that seems to occur when the body falls down and starts to cool and stink, and it's time to burn it or bury it or set it up where the birds can pick it down to the bones. So, you know, this has been, I think, the one unifying element. If all these religions have one unifying element, it is their inability to understand the post-death experience. Even if the post-death experience is nothing but the abyss, it's just nothing except what the pre-life experience was. Do you remember anything from your pre-life? Of course not. Now who knows? Well, you know, when I say I'm an atheist, you know what I mean by that. If there is a consciousness, who knows? I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But all of those religions up there represented, except Wicca. Wicca has a presence in the United States. It is forced, for the most part, to go underground, although the United States Army, for God's sake, has granted recognition to the Wiccan Church on various bases around the country for celebrations, religious celebrations to be held. The religions of Native Americans, to the best of my watching that this morning, I didn't see any of that either. You know, the belief in the Great Spirit and unfocused religious belief, unfocused to the non-Native American mind like mine. But those two religions that are truly earth-centered, truly, we could probably all get something positive from if we were listened to it. And experience it instead of the craziness that seems to swirl around Christianity and Judaism and Islam. The perpetual arguments and disagreements and bloodshed and war and contempt and disrespect. And, you know, even though they all stand up and say, well, you know, we all believe in the same God. Oh, do you? Well, then why have you been slaughtering each other for two millennia? You know, I mean, hello. But there they all were, Sikhs and Hindus and Jews and Muslims and, excuse me, various shades of Christians. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. Now, it was moving to me in the sense that it was very reminiscent. I got all these sense memories from when I was in church. I could almost smell the pews of my grandmother's Baptist church. Sitting on the bed in my bedroom looking at the TV screen. I could almost smell that. What is that smell? It's furniture polish and old Bibles and carpeting. You know that smell that you experience in a church if the church has been around for a while. And then, of course, in the front of the pew or the back of the pew in front of you where the songbooks go, my grandmother's church were also the fans, you know, those handheld wooden handled fans, and the fan part of the fan always had the name of a funeral parlor on it, you know, not a gas station, not a bank. It was always a funeral parlor. It's like, okay, point made, point taken. But the other thing, I love to watch politicians go to church. See, I truly believe in separation of church and state for all the obvious reasons, but for a less obvious reason, I guess. And that is because religion to me always was such a personal, private thing. My grandmother used to tell me that the Bible said if you wanted to pray, that Jesus said, you know, go into your closet and pray. You know, the public prayers, people who prayed in public were Pharisees, hypocrites, jackasses, although I don't think he used that word. And, you know, it kind of stuck with me. When you learn things at your grandmother's knee, it sticks with you. Whether you disbelieve it at a later age or not, you still have the memories. You still remember. I still remember long conversations that my grandmother had with me about the Bible. So, anyway, you can tell by the body language of the people you're watching in church who's comfortable in being there and who is not. You can tell who's been there on a regular basis and who is simply there for the photo op or the hypocrisy. Now, I guess these Christians understand that one of the greatest sins, if not the greatest sin, to Jesus was hypocrisy. Wasn't it Jesus or was it just God? No, I think it was Jesus. It was hypocrisy. But as I watched the body language of these people today, I was reminded of Bush and Bush 1 and Reagan, all of them poseurs. And none of them really, you know, especially Reagan. Reagan was as familiar with the church as I'm familiar with the inside of a bank vault. But Obama and Clinton, you see, having really been brought up in the church, the Protestant Christian church, I found that fascinating. At one point, I watched Clinton sitting there, Bill Clinton, with, I swear to God, his mouth hanging open because he was so into the singer. And if you didn't see that singer, Dr. Wintley Phipps, singing Amazing Grace, you missed something, brother and sister. You really missed something. That was the part that got to me. Amazing Grace is one of my great all-time church songs anyway. But when Dr. Wintley Phipps was singing, woo, Lord have mercy, I was ready to get on my knees and put my hand on the TV screen and beg Jesus to come into my life. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, it was that powerful. But I didn't. I stayed sitting on the bed and watched Clinton with his mouth open because he was so taken with this. And Barack, and to a lesser degree, Michelle Obama, kind of nodding and moving with the cadences of the various preachers. The main preacher was a female. Was she Episcopal? I'm not sure. Methodist? I'm not sure. But she was a female preacher, pastor, and you know, gave quite a sermon. I got a little more on this. We got to take a break here coming up. But watching this today was just, it started to occur to me, maybe Barack Obama is being sincere about bringing people together. I mean, a lot of presidents have said that, and it was just didn't mean diddly squat. You know, it was just to mystify us. It was hanging something in front of our eyes that was sparkly while they reached around and stole our children and murdered our bank accounts. But maybe Barack Obama is sincere. Hmm? A little more on this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is him. This is the song.
How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Blind, but
you really ought to Google this. Obama, Amazing Grace, Wintley Smith, prayer service, whatever. And it runs about 4.5 minutes. You ought to listen to this guy sing. It's an incredible rendition. Even better than Judy Collins' version. But anyway, watching all this and listening to all this, you know, almost maybe want to throw in again with the Sunday school crowd. Almost, but of course not quite. But it was because I do understand. I mean, I do understand. And in a couple of months, I'm going to be one of the speakers at the atheist convention in Atlanta. But it was really interesting to watch. Now, the most interesting part from a freaked out point of view. Not from the religion, you know. I mean, watching these people really, truly praying to God and, you know, trying their best to be ecumenical in this place, in that place, in front of that crowd. That part was singularly involving for me. You know, I did. I sat there for a good 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and watched. Just like being in church on Sunday. But I'll tell you the really, really strange part. Now, for those of you who attend church, or attend, maybe this is a kid thing, I can remember the best times in church for me was when they gave the benediction. Right? And it was all over. You didn't have to sit there quiet with your grandma ready to reach over and pinch you if you shuffled your butt around in the pew. And it was all over. And that was the best part, man. When they gave the benediction and everybody stood up, put their hymnals back in the rack in the pew in front of you, and people were standing up, moving towards the aisles, and all of a sudden where there had been silence and the smell of linseed oil and carpeting, now all of a sudden people were talking, and because they'd all been sitting there quiet, and because most of the people there were old, nobody had been saying anything for the past hour, when they talked, you notice they all had bad breath, right? You know, that was the thing that used to get me, like, oh, God, because all the old people leaned down,
oh, look at Angelo's grandson, hello, sweetheart, ah, get away!
But the best part was coming outside of the church, man. That feeling of being released. I am released from church. It was really great. Well, there was some of that after they gave the benediction today. But the really, really, really good part was when the camera started panning through the crowd and towards the middle of the congregants starting to stand up and everything with John McCain. There he was, McCain. Now, that's not the good part. The good part was he brought his familiar with him, his haint, his shade, his daemon. There he was, Joe Lieberman. Oh, my God. He's still following McCain around. He even into church. It was awesome. Woo! 25 before the hour, that is Dr. Wintley Phipps singing Amazing Grace. And if you don't know the history of that song, check it out on Wikipedia or Google. It has a very interesting genesis. But at the National Cathedral this morning, I really was snared by it, as the song says. Got caught in one of the snares of watching this, and right at the point where Dr. Wintley Phipps, and of course when he was finished, he received a standing ovation from everybody who was there. Powerful, powerful imagery. Now, of course, one has to blank out a whole bunch of stuff about religion in order to appreciate, at least I do, blank out a whole bunch of historical reality about religion. in order to appreciate just a simple, and it was simple, a lot of folks were there, a lot of different denominations were there. The whole point of this, I'm sorry if I'm belaboring this point, and you're waiting for me to get to the Sturm und Drang of the program, but the point of all that this was, it really made me wonder about Barack Obama. We'll see, won't we? We'll see rather quickly. There's already some friction developing. It's not being identified as friction, but it is friction nonetheless between Obama's plan of 16 months in getting all of our troops out of Iraq and the military kind of pushing for 3 years for a more orderly withdrawal. From a strategic, from a standpoint of all the equipment that we have there, a three-year withdrawal would make more sense. From a standpoint of getting out because we had no business being there, it's a tough situation. Now, the Afghanistan issue is the one that will be very curious to. It will be curious to me to see how this is handled. We really don't have any business in Afghanistan, as far as I'm concerned. I forget the reason we went there, except I do know this. The invasion of Afghanistan came shortly after the 9/11 attack, yes, but it was also shortly after the mullahs, the religious leaders of Afghanistan at the time, the Taliban, in other words, were invited to Houston, where they had a big sit-down with Unocal Oil Company and representatives of the Bush crime family and oil magnates from the United States. And the meeting was to get permission from the Taliban to build a pipeline across Afghanistan, which is landlocked, into Pakistan and then to the sea, to bring out all that Caspian Sea, that Central Asian natural gas. And the Taliban didn't want anything to do with it. So this really pissed off the United States. Well, not the United States. The oil men who were the corporate oil people who were poised to really take over the country. And then they did, of course, with the selection of George Bush as president. And then the most gratuitous and fortuitous, the most fortuitous of events occurred for these people with the attack of September 11, 2001. And shortly thereafter, of course, we invaded. Now, ostensibly, we invaded to track down Osama bin Laden, which was a lie. Osama bin Laden was the cover story. The real thing was to get in there, support the so-called Northern Alliance that was fighting the Taliban, and take over the country. Put in our puppet. Our puppet's there, but our puppet, Hamid Karzai, turns out to be just a corrupt, weaselly, money-grubbing son of a bitch who is doing nothing except guaranteeing a resurgence of the Taliban, you see? So whether or not Barack Obama listens to his inner leader and says to himself, you know, this is really madness. If we want Barack Obama, if we wanted him 8 years ago, then it should have been handled the same way the bombers of the first attack on the trade towers, how the pursuit of them was handled. They're all in prison, serving life without parole. They were caught, tried, afforded the best of American justice, convicted, and sent to prison. So they'll never bomb again. Timothy McVeigh was caught, tried, sent to prison, and executed. So he will never bomb again. So, a very pivotal event for me in this Barack Obama presidency will be what his decision is ultimately where it concerns Afghanistan. The NATO countries that have been shanghaied into this are wanting out into this military action in Afghanistan. It is literally, absolutely, totally, completely, no doubt, impossible for any foreign military power to completely subdue and control Afghanistan. It is not going to happen, not by us, not by all the armies over history who have tried. It cannot be done. There are certain things that cannot be done. Pushing a string, striking a match on a wet cake of soap, subduing and controlling Afghanistan. It can't be done. Now, Barack Obama's advisors, I would assume, I would hope, are sitting down with him at some point and saying, let's take a look at why we're there to begin with. And what we created that caused us to go there. We're the ones that created the Mujahideen. We made them. That just as though we were some supreme being reaching into the sands of Afghanistan and created fighters, Mujahideen, to fight the Soviets. And we armed them. Oh, God, did we arm them. Now, the thing that always bothers me is that you and I, in our little worlds, can take a look at history that goes back to Alexander the Great and history that goes back to 2002. We can look at all this and we can think, this is not going to work. I mean, it's as plain as the cross around your neck or the Star of David hanging on your cufflinks or the nose on your face. It's not going to work. You know it, and I know it. Our presence there is destabilizing Pakistan that happens to be nuclear armed. I mean, I'm not going to go through all this. You know the immediate history and the long-term history of that region of the world. For the West, that's us, or the Brits, or the Greeks, or the Russians, for the West to get involved in that, the internal affairs, as primitive and religiously insane as they may be, for us to get involved in that is crazy. If we wanted the perpetrators, and keep in mind that the perpetrators of 9/11 all died, if we're to believe the official story. The hijackers were incinerated, just like the 3,000 souls that they also incinerated. So who were we going after? The mastermind. Well, I thought that was Sheikh Khalid Muhammad or Sheikh Omar or who was it? Our own leaders, quote, said, Osama bin Laden? Oh, we don't care about him. You know, he doesn't make any difference. Go to the FBI website and see if you can find a wanted poster or any kind of notification that says the FBI is looking for Osama bin Laden for mass murder on U.S. soil. Go ahead. See if you can find it. So maybe Barack Obama will get the proper advice. And the proper advice would be a drawdown of U.S. forces and out. Just get out. Just get out. Leave the religious crazies to their religious craziness. Will people suffer? I don't know. Do the women walking around in the burqas suffer? Do the children who are sent to madrasas suffer? I don't know. I mean, do we suffer? Do the children here in the United States suffer? Do the women that live in this country suffer? I don't know. Isn't it a matter of perspective? I do know this. Every time we show up with our gunships and our bombs and our white phosphorus, or any country shows up with that kind of weaponry and our F-16s or F-18s or whatever the hell we're using now, and we show up and we say, well, we're going to bring you democracy, a lot of people are about to die. And not because they've selected democracy, but because we, that's the neoliberal sickness. Oh, well, we're going to force democracy down these sons of bitches' throats, and then we can have our pipeline. Well, isn't it time to just get out?
To salute our president, because in these times we must fall in line. There's no room for dissent. I support the troops, my friend, so I drive an SUV in honor of those brave young souls who died to give the right to me. You know gasoline ain't free.
Get your rage on. It's Mike Malloy. Take a long walk to a
company town. 10 before the hour. We're going to have to do some new promos, Kathy, because you know, as unsettling as the Obama presidency might turn out to be, it'll be nowhere near what we've experienced for the past 8 years. So that's going to be a project here. We got to stop using those get your rage on things.
But I have a theory.
Yeah.
I think that what's going to happen possibly is that as Obama is in office and things are discovered about the previous administration, there's going to be lots of fresh things to be angry about. It's going to take a long time to recover from those 8 years, and I don't think we've seen the last of the torture papers. I don't think we've seen the last of the death and destruction and murder and mayhem and maiming that this group of thugs did for 8 years. I think little bits and drips and drabs will come out, and believe me, it'll piss you off.
Well, I'm certainly not disputing that. What I'm saying is the object of the contempt or the rage that I felt for 8 years is not going to be no matter how this turns out, unless Barack Obama turns out to be a flesh-eating Nazi. Like Dick Cheney was, it's whatever discomfort or push to the left or whatever I wind up doing on this program, if it stays on the air, you never know with the economy the way it is. But whatever we wind up doing, I just am either burned out with the rage. I mean, literally burned out with the rage, or in addition to being burned out, I don't see where Barack Obama and his administration is going to inspire that kind of attitude on my part. Yeah, I'll come at so many of these issues that will come up in the Obama administration from a more left point, but on the political spectrum, a more liberal point, I should say, if that's left, whatever. But it's just not going to Barack Obama. I've seen enough now over the past 2 years. I mean, we have come to have a sense of this guy. Over the past 2 years, I keep hearing pundits on television, like Chris Matthews and some of these other people, saying, well, you know, he plays everything very close to his chest. He's very cool, calm, and collected. Nobody knows what he's thinking, yada, yada, yada. I don't agree. I think the press is so used to having clowns and morons and jackasses, you know, starting with Ronald Reagan, who acted his way through 8 years of the presidency, and then a complete gibbering doofus like Pappy Bush, and then, of course, Bill Clinton, who truly was a clown, a brilliant clown. I've never questioned Clinton's intellect. And then George W. Bush, 8 years of this freak show, this murder circus. And so, yeah, the press doesn't know how to respond to somebody who displays dignity. Huh? Very simple. Hey, guys, here's your word, dignity. Look it up, okay? Cool, calm, and collected. Maybe you can get your minds around that a little bit more easily than the word dignity. But that's Barack Obama. You know, no drama Obama. That's not just, you know, somebody's cute little phrase. That's absolutely true. And if this is his persona, his real deep-rooted persona, then you can bet your ass it's going to be his policies. How could it be otherwise? And Barack Obama is not in any way ignorant. This guy has forgotten more than George Bush ever will know in his entire life, Bush. So we have a president here who is truly an intellectual, and which is not to take away his humanity. I think his humanity is there too. Don't forget, he was an organizer. He was a neighborhood, a youth, or whatever the hell he was. So we don't have a complete someone from the academy here, strictly from the academy. We have that, but we also have somebody who understands the street. So who knows? Now, back during the campaign, in the primaries, yeah, I had a lot of criticisms and still do. Some of the backers, some of the people who were standing behind Barack Obama, some of the heavy contributors, some of the appointments he's made are very suspect to a traditional liberal like I am. But on the other hand, who knows what kind of rope-a-dope Barack Obama is playing here? In addition to being an intellectual and cool, calm, and collected, and going to be a true leader, I think he also understands the wonderful world of jiu-jitsu. He is not going to allow these people to do to him, these people being the right wing, the conservative crazies, these psychopathic Republicans. He will not allow them to do to him what they did to Bill Clinton. It's not going to happen. It isn't. And one of the ways I think Obama is just pulling out their circuits. He's reaching inside their heads and pulling out the wiring. And they don't even know it. You know, a dumbass like John Boehner is going to wake up some morning and jump out of bed, and his ass is going to fall off. And he's going to stand around, turn around, look at his ass laying on the floor. He says, how did that happen? And the way it happened was Barack Obama disconnected all of his circuits. So John Boehner, being 90% ass, it just fell off. And there's a lot of them in Congress that's going to happen to. A lot of them. I'll tell you one it's really going to happen to, and it's going to hit him like a train wreck, is this Senator Cornyn from Texas. Barack Obama, I'm beginning to believe, is doing to these people what Muhammad Ali did to so many who got in the ring with him and said, well, I'm just going to box this sucker out. I'm just going to whip him and become the champion. And Muhammad Ali just said, okay, let's see what you got. Rope-a-dope. So we'll see. That's where I am on the Obama presidency. And, you know, I have a lot of leftist listeners, I think, unless they've all said, screw Malloy, he's turned into a wimp, who listen to this and go, boy, are you being suckered? No, I'm not. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is just about 7 past the hour. We're expecting a phone call tonight from Steve, the guy that calls the program every once in a while, works in the financial services industry. You've heard him talk to us about the credit card beast that is about to be unleashed. And he sent me an email the other night towards the end of the program. And I emailed him back, said, let's call in tomorrow night. And he said he would. So we're waiting to hear from Steve. In the meantime, just a couple more things. It's amazing how astute or perceptive little kids are, or they're just little kids. You know, we usually teach that out of them, don't we? Their natural curiosity and their powers of observation that are very seldom filtered. You know, I'm talking about young kids because I got one. They don't filter stuff. Stuff comes in and they don't analyze. They don't look at it using critical thinking. It's just, you ask a 4.5-year-old kid to report on an event, whether it is a colony of ants in the backyard or the moon coming up or whatever it is, you're going to get just a straightforward, impressionistic report. You know, that's the beauty of kids. Now, as they get older, of course, and start to learn what the rules are, the rules concerning perception as well as reality. Once they start to learn the rules And they learn in the hardest ways, don't they? By people yelling at them or telling them no, or people setting up boundaries, whether it's parents or religious teachers or school teachers. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. William Golding's book, Lord of the Flies, is a perfect example of how children, they certainly, even though Jesus said, such is the kingdom of God, they get to a certain age, 8, 9, 10 years old, and without that kind of restrictive environment, they can become little monsters. But at this age, 3, 4, 5, 6, everything is impressionistic. Everything that comes in to their minds, it comes in without the filters on. Hence, yeah, this is a Molly story. Hence, Molly came home from preschool today. I was still up in the bedroom. Now I'm reading the paper. And cover in the New York Times today, if you saw it, a gorgeous picture of the Obamas walking part of the parade route. If you saw that cover, it was just like the smiles on these two people, they just radiate genuineness. They really do. And okay, yeah. I may come to realize at some point that it was all trickery, hickory, dickory, dock, but at this point, I don't think so. So here's this gorgeous photograph of Barack and Michelle Obama. It takes up two-thirds of the front page of the paper. And Molly comes in, and she sees it laying on the bed, and she looks at it, and she said, "He's the good one, right?" And I said, "Yes, he's the good one." And I said, "You know who that is?" And she said, he's the leader." I said, "That's right. He's the president. Do you know what a president is?" And she said, "Is he like the line leader? You know, when they all line up to go pee at her preschool every day, somebody else gets to be the line leader. And there's the door opener and the light turner offer and they all take turns." She says, "Is that like a line leader?" I said, "Kind of." I said, "Now, do you know what a president does?" And she looked at me and she said, "Yeah, he helps people." Whew. You know, I just said, "You're right, Molly. You're right. He helps people." So, Prairie 2 sends in his missive this evening, our economics advisor, under the subject line, "Bush has his last chip in the pot and draws to an inside straight." Prairie 2 writes, "Hey, Mike, the lack of pardons from Bush for his crime family seems puzzling, but it makes sense if you consider that he and Cheney have been going around admitting to war crimes. They must know that what they've done will come out soon, so they have taken up the Jack Bauer defense, claiming that they did what they did for patriotic reasons. If Bush issued pardons, he would be admitting that what they did was illegal under U.S. law, and a pardon wouldn't protect them from an international prosecution. By claiming patriotism, they hope to get protection from extradition long enough to sneak away as the collapsing economy creates a distraction." Prairie 2. And, I certainly don't disagree with that at all. Hillary Clinton will arrive at the State Department tomorrow morning. She is the new Secretary of State, of course. What was the vote today? 96-2 or 94-2? What was it? 94-2? This after John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas, held up her confirmation for one day. You know why he did that? Because he can. That's the only reason. That prevented the Senate from voting by unanimous consent. They took a voice vote yesterday. Was it a voice vote? And they had to take a roll call vote on the nomination today. And this is the petty, nasty ass little 10-year-old crap that Republicans do. And I think this specifically is an example of what Obama was talking about in his inauguration speech about putting away childish things. But that's an impossibility for Republicans. Republicans have not only infantilized the political system in this country, or attempted to, but they've also turned it into something nasty and ugly and dirty, caca, poo-poo, that sort of thing. So Cornyn, you know, Cornyn said, yeah, I'm going to vote for her, but because I can hold up her nomination was the implication, I'll do it. Just so everybody knows that I'm here. I still fart. I still burp. I'm here, you know, just because Barack Obama is the star of the day. I'm still here. I'm the fart burp from Texas. I'm John Cornyn. Erp, burp. Cornyn said he knew Clinton would be, or Cornyn said he knew Clinton would be confirmed, but he said he delayed the vote because he wanted more time to talk about the foundation run by her husband. Which is bat's not. I mean, it's ridiculous. If he wanted to check, for any reason, check on Clinton's husband, well, then talk to Clinton's husband. Jerk. And he wrote to Hillary Clinton last week, according to CNN, he wrote this, quote, I remain deeply troubled that America's foreign policy and your diplomatic mission will be encumbered by the sweeping global activities of the Clinton Foundation unless tighter foreign fundraising restrictions and transparency protocols are adopted by her husband's organization. Oh, transparency. Oh, I see. That's what you pissants are requiring now is how about you know, who cares about Bill Clinton's foundation? What? Is there some terrorist group that's sending money? Transparency. This from John Cornyn, a Republican piece of human waste who made no such claim about transparency where it concerned energy policy for the entire United States, as laid forth by Dick Cheney after a series of private meetings in his office. Isn't it amazing how these hypocritical, thumb-sucking, little infantilized creeps like John Cornyn are willing to whine and bitch and dance around like their underpants are on fire where it concerns Clinton's nomination. There are so many reasons to oppose Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State. But what her husband does with his foundation is not one of them. Not given the history of Republicans. In a political system where Republicans had any honor, any sense of morality or ethics, maybe Cornyn would have had a point. But Cornyn is a cheat, a sneak, and a liar, not to mention the fact that he's also a dumbass Texas Republican. But I repeat myself. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Faster than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
I'm a driver, I'm a winner. Things are gonna change, I can feel it.
It's 21 past the hour. All right, let's do a phone call here. It's certainly on topic. Let's go to Hack, who is calling in from Missouri, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hack, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
It's moving along, Hack.
You know something? I think a surefire reason to actually nominate Hillary for Secretary of State, if for nothing else, just to see Republicards like John Cornyn squirm. That's been my hobby here as of late.
Yeah, that's true. You have a point.
Watching these idiots squirm.
And squirm he did. The thing that bothers me, though, is, as I'm sure it bothers you, this obstructionism now, the Republicans, they don't have a counter-argument to make to policies, whether it was back in the Clinton era or now in the Obama era. So and if they did have a counter policy or a different idea, they have no ideas. The Republican Party is devoid of ideas. It's dead. It is in fact a zombie. It's dead, but it's still walking. The Republican Party and the members of the Republican Party in Congress are therefore zombies also. If they had something to offer, instead of Hillary Clinton, let's do this. Instead of money for the public to get through this rough patch, let's do this. Instead of socialized medicine, let's do this. But they don't have anything, so they have to resort to what Cornyn resorted to today. And the proof of that, look at the vote, 94-2. And of those 94, how many are Republicans? Of 44?
58 of them, actually.
No, Republicans.
Oh, I'm sorry, 58. 42.
42. 42 or, well, I th- no, I th- is that it? 42? 42 Republicans. So 40 of them voted yay for Clinton. So what was Cornyn's point? Nothing.
Oh, yeah.
It's nothing. And all of them. Mitch McConnell is, gearing up his little,
Was he the other nay vote?
No, Cornyn was not one of the nay votes. Cornyn voted yes. Can you
I
see
thought
that?
He was one of the nay votes.
No, that's the thing. That's the thing that is so damn irritating.
Oh, that's committee.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, a veteran in committee.
Yeah, the guy, the senator from Louisiana, the senator from South Carolina. And of course, it's going to be a couple of white Southerners. Of course it is. I mean, that's just the way it goes. So anyway.
Yep, you know it.
All right, Hack, thanks for checking in, pal. I appreciate it, all right?
Thank you for all you do. I'm telling you, you're an inspiration, Mike. Nothing short of.
Well, okay. Thanks, Hack. Take care. Take care. Good to hear from you. Got an email here for, well, no, we have to break here pretty quick, don't we? Yeah. A woman named Suzanne, who lives in Columbus, Georgia, sent this to me. And you know, I'm always astonished when I hear, like, Suzanne in Columbus, Georgia, or Edie over in what she calls Dogpatch, Alabama, or Memphis Mary, or who's our regular emailer from South Carolina? I mean, we just seem to have this whole clutch of women. Kate from the Mississippi Gulf Coast, a whole clutch of women who listen to this program. In the South, white women. We have black women too. But this regular list of emailers of white women in the South, who write some of the most astute observations about what's going on down here in Bohunkville, so many times. And I've got one of those in a moment here from Suzanne in Columbus, Georgia. But have you noticed that, Kathy? South Carolina, Louisiana, Florida, you know, Susanna, Florida, that's Miami. That's not, you know, it's south as opposed to being northeast or west. But, you know, I'm talking about the old Confederate South pretty much. But Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, and I swear to God, if we had as wealthy a program as the pig man, Rush Limbaugh, or his parrot, Sean Hannity, I swear to God, I would just rent a hall over here in Atlanta and send all these people airplane tickets and get them over here and just have a great big getting up morning Jack Daniels and Diet Coke convention of this group of white Southern gals. Now the black Southern gals write to me all the time are going, well, what about us? Yeah, no, you too. You know what I'm saying? Come on. But it never fails to amaze me. So when we come back, I want to share with you what Suzanne in Columbus, Georgia wrote about the inauguration. you're going to find this kind of interesting if you live out of the South. If you live here in the South, you'll just shake your head and go, that's right.
Watch it. En j'entends des chansons, c'est si bon de se dire des mots doux.
It's okay, Republicans. The pain will be over soon. Take a deep breath. Find your happy place. It's more of Mike Malloy.
All right, we are going to we're going to share with you now. This was about 3 years ago, right after Hurricane Katrina struck the Mississippi Gulf Coast in our part of the world, as Bush used to put it. And they sent Laura Pickles Bush over to one of the homeless emergency shelters where people were piling in because their lives had been utterly and in some instances irrevocably destroyed. Meanwhile, the government of the United States, under the control of Bush and the Republicans, sat there and did nothing. I still cannot process what I saw on television those 3 days after Hurricane Katrina and the absolute chaos and destruction. And all the faces were black. And had that been San Diego? Please. So they sent Laura Bush to stroke the people in one of these shelters.
And while all that was going on, I just find the irony palpable that Bush and McCain were both literally eating cake.
They were, yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, they were eating birthday cake. So here's Laura in one of her chipper little presentations to a group of people in West Texas at a shelter.
I want to extend a warm Texas welcome to this fabulous and palatial shelter to all the destitute, dank, and dispossessed residents of the once great city of Louisiana huddled here today. Looking at your wretched, waterlogged faces slumped on your cots, clutching your paltry possessions, I wish I could reach through this mylar jumpsuit and hug the fumigated among you and offer some comfort and reassurance as you weather this difficult storm. Help is finally on the way. Very soon, my staff will be dispersing debit cards as well as emergency anti-anxiety and psychotropic rations from my very own personal medicine cabinet to counteract the floods of double-plus ungood feelings you may be experiencing. I hope you ripe refugees know that almost every Caucasian American citizen is rooting for you. It is one of my Bushy's top priorities to reconstruct the state of New Orleans, and many of your more amusing establishments and individual hovels will be rebuilt to their dubious glory once again. In times of misery and despair, it is important to maintain a positive attitude, get some perspective, take some personal responsibility, and count your blessings and remaining family members, and realize that, in a way, Hurricane Katrina gave you the opportunity for a fresh start. After all, you are safe and secure in this heavily guarded FEMA relocation sanitation camp, which is certainly an improvement from your previous shack or teepee or hut or whatever structures you little people lived in before the floodwaters turned your third world nation into a bowl of diseased and grimy gumbo. Many of you feel this muddy mess could have somehow been averted had my Bushy heeded the repeated numerous warnings and computer simulations predicting the potential flooding and dire consequences of underfunding both emergency response units and infrastructure maintenance programs. But now is not the time for finger-pointing as we work hard to solve problems that are in no way our fault or responsibility or that we had any foreknowledge of or part in creating. No one could have predicted this kind of tragedy. And besides, you can't expect Bushy to read, much less comprehend, the trivial conclusions of every scholarly scientific study or dry observations of another dreary bureaucratic memo like increased federal funding critical for Southeast Louisiana flood control, or Gulf hurricane predicted to kill thousands, or Osama determined to strike in the U.S. It may be true that many senior government officials in charge of disaster relief did not have actual hands-on disaster relief experience per se. However, Karl Rove did prepare them to cope with the worst-case scenarios of Hurricane Catalina by supplying their teams with the complete DVD collections of all the Mad Max films and Kevin Costner's Waterworld. In addition, despite the partisan blame gaming you're hearing from uppity mayors and unfeminine governors and senators with questionable dye jobs who want you to believe my Bushy is a modern-day Nero or gender-confused Marie Antoinette who lazily strummed the guitar and nibbled on cake instead of responding appropriately to the alleged crisis, nothing could be farther from the truth. When a senior staffer and part-time rodeo clown at the ranch informed Bushy that the dikes were broken, he just innocently assumed the Indigo Girls had been in some kind of minor accident. Honestly, who wouldn't? But after only a mere 24 hours, a short 9 holes, and an abbreviated 12 hours of shut-eye, Bushy leapt into immediate action, clearly and sympathetically displaying his concern and connection by flying over your bloated bayou from 25,000 feet, gazing down with amazement and slight geographic confusion at what Haley Barber would later explain to him was an American coastal region and populous, scattered, smothered, and covered like so many Waffle House hash browns. As for the criticism that FEMA Chief Brownie's former career in the equestrian sector didn't sufficiently prepare him for this position, my Bushy figured that anyone brave enough to spend time on or around actual real living snorting scary Arabian horses was more than capable of handling whatever inconvenient cloudbursts might come our way. FEMA has issued a series of disaster survival guides that are currently being dispersed over the city by otherwise useless military medical helicopters, urging the residents to take advantage of the unexpected yet beneficial consequences of Hurricane Thumbelina. And in an unprecedented act of humanitarian aid, Vice President Cheney has recently been defrosted, reanimated, and deployed to the area to use his special hunting skills to train the burgeoning population of urban outdoorsmen who are now in possession of stolen shotguns and munitions to forage and hunt for fish and rodents and roadkill and whatever other mutant amphibious creatures may have survived the deluge. So there's no need to starve when your women folk exercise their native Nolans creative culinary skills and cook up a mess of improvised dirty rice and raging Cajun campfire etouffee. Friends, the time for gloom and doom is almost over. Even the most deadly and dangerous storm cloud has a silver lining. So turn that frown upside down. After all, you people are known for your upbeat optimism, can-do spirit, generous hips, and near-perfect rhythm. Before you know it, your frightened, homeless, confused children will be back in school somewhere, wearing white shoes and flying kites. The witchy women will be working their gree-gree, making those voodoo dolls. All troubles will be forgotten, and we'll be sipping mint juleps on Trent Lott's fabulous new porch, looking back and having a good chuckle at this clammy calamity. So as we look to the future, let's raise a glass, drop in a purification tablet, and laissez les bon temps rouler.
God, aren't you glad she's gone? No, actually, I'm going to miss Pickles. I'm going to miss old Pickles, I swear to God. Dear Mike, I live down in the backwards South, Columbus, Georgia, to be exact. As you can imagine, it is hell. It is very similar to the way you describe your area, North Georgia. I was so lucky to get to experience the inauguration all day. I was able to catch the festivities on the television where I work. My husband wanted to watch the swearing-in and hurried to one of his favorite lunch spots in time to see Mr. Obama take the oath of office. As he settled in with his meal and gazed at the big screen, he saw Barack Obama raise his hand and begin to recite the oath. My husband turned his head for a second. When he turned back, the television channel had mysteriously changed to ESPN. He turned around to try to spot who had control of the remote. The restaurant was crowded, and he could not spot the culprit. He said that the customers didn't skip a beat and kept eating their meals. I told him it must have been the owner of the restaurant. I hate to stereotype anyone, but the restaurant owner is an older white man who has the look of a racist. I've seen plenty of racist men in my life, and he looks the part. He's mean and hateful. He's mean and hateful looking and white. Oh, so white. The story made my blood boil. It made me angry that on this day in 2009 in this country where Barack Obama won the election fairly and by a landslide, that racists like this little man tried to ruin the day for everyone in his restaurant. It made me angry that my husband did not say anything. It made me angry that he was afraid to. It made me angry that no one else cared to say anything. Were they afraid to, or did they agree with him? Can that many prejudiced people be contained in one place at the same time? The thought of that scares the hell out of me. What makes me even more angry is the fact that this restaurant carries the name and original recipes of a very old black-owned business that began back in 1929. The motto of this place is Eatin' Fine Since 29. It's a barbecue joint with a very unique sauce. After several decades under the ownership of a local black family, it closed and remained closed for many years. It has only been in the last decade or so that this company came back under the new ownership of this white man and his wife. They even have a mural of the old restaurant on their walls. It is included among the tacky ceramic pigs and NASCAR decor that so many southern barbecue restaurants seem to favor. The fact that this white man, who is getting rich off a black man's idea, would spoil this important day angers me to the core. What nerve he had to assume that everyone in the place felt the same way he did, but I guess they agreed with him when they didn't say anything. What a slap in the face to the previous owners and the few black customers that still patronize this establishment. Most of the black people that come there are just loyal to the food and get their orders to go. The dine-in clientele is mostly old white men. I told my husband that I would never eat there again. He says he can't promise that. He's addicted to their food. I don't know how I feel about that, yet I appreciate his honesty. I just wanted to share the slice of hell from Columbus, Georgia. Thanks, Mike. I love your show. Sincerely, Suzanne. Yeah, I understand that. Thanks, Suzanne. Thanks for reminding me once again, as if I needed it, of where I live. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Tree hugging, peace loving, pot smoking, porn watching, lazy ass hippies like me. Tree hugging, love making, pro choice and gay wedding, widespread digging hippies like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing, and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man. Down.
Nighty night, truth seekers. Time to snuggle up with your favorite screamer. More Mike Malloy.
It's about 9 minutes before the hour. I just get such interesting emails in here. And before we break for the top of the hour, I want to share one more with you. Jean wrote this regarding Amazing Grace. We played earlier Reverend Phipps, who. Or not Reverend, but Doctor. I think it's Doctor. Yeah, Doctor Phipps, who did Amazing Grace at the prayer service this morning, which is a traditional prayer service the day after the inauguration, and it's pretty powerful. Gene writes, not to take anything from the vocal talent or arrangement of Doctor Phipps, I agree he handles Amazing Grace well, But I'd have to say that Odetta's rendering of that song moved me more. Unlike you, Amazing Grace was not a song I've ever particularly liked. I always had a problem with the phrase, a wretch like me. The idea that we are worms at the foot of the cross, the requisite self-degradation, low self-esteem, that accompanies many, if not most, religions, seems unhealthy to me. But then, I'm no Christian, and I'm not absolutely certain of much.
Well, I prefer Molly's rendition when Molly was singing the song in Thanksgiving, and she sang, "It saved a wrench like me."
A wrench. Anyway, Jean goes on, "One night, I went out looking for some live music in my hometown, Austin, Texas. I dropped by a bar I used to frequent, Emma Joe's. In there were Jack Elliott, Tom Paxton, Dave Von Ronk, and Odetta. All apparently just happened to drop in, or at least they were not advertised, and all of them performed. Anyway, Odetta took the stage and said, and I'm paraphrasing here, the feeling isn't quite right in here, but it will be. With that cryptic statement, she launched into Amazing Grace. I was moved to tears, much to my dismay. I'm not given to strong emotions, though not because of the general feeling that emotions convey weakness. I've never encountered a performer with such stage presence and power. It's a thing you cannot get from listening to recordings. I feel fortunate to have experienced her. I'm reminded of a song written by a talented friend, Don Taylor, which contained the line, Lord, I'm no Christian. I just love the music, and maybe I will till I'll die. So sing one more chorus of the old rugged cross, and don't be surprised if I cry. Just sing it, and don't ask me why. Either I or Don will sometimes perform Don's song in small gatherings with very mixed listeners, and it never fails to move them, though occasionally a Christian of the more primitive or concrete variety will be offended or frightened by the lyrics. Jean." Yeah, the old rugged cross, that was another one that used to upset me when I was a kid, when they would sing that in my grandmother's church, because, like Jean says here, a lot of the older folks would just have tears coming down their cheeks when they sang the old rugged cross. On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. And I love that old cross where the dearest and best for a world of lost sinners was slain. And so on and so on and so on. But, yeah, there's an awful lot about Christian music, religious music, that is emotional. It's designed to be. I mean, that's the whole point, right? I feel like we're doing church tonight, and we're not supposed to do that on the Malloy program, are we? Here's a news flash for you. China has approved universal health care. Now, you know what's ironic about this? I was just reading in today's New York Times. Was it today's or yesterday's? That China and India now provide, I think they said 60 to 80% of the raw materials for all the prescription drugs used by the United States, Europe, South America. And that was a bit upsetting to me. It really was. I take Lipitor, and I'd like to know that and Lisinopril. I'd like to know that the two drugs I take are made here. Why is that? I don't know. I guess because I've read so much about the conditions of these little factories in China, factories my ass, these little kitchen chemistry labs in China and now India. That just enough that it makes me a little bit nervous. well, more than a little bit nervous. So now we find out that China will spend $124 billion to offer health care to its 1.3 billion citizens. According to the information here, at a meeting of the nation's state council, presided over by Premier Wen Jiabao, the expenditure which aims to guarantee universal medical coverage to China's population by 2011, was approved, the news agency Xinhua reported Wednesday. Today, growing public criticism of soaring medical fees, a lack of access to affordable medical services, poor doctor-patient relationships, and low medical insurance coverage compelled the government to launch the new round of reforms. That's according to the report issued by the State Council. Measures to be taken between now and 2011 include equalizing the level of care available in urban and rural areas, cataloging and supervising drugs, and the launch of a pilot program to overhaul hospital administration, operation, and supervision. Primary health care will become accessible to everybody. My goodness. Welcome back. It's 7 past the hour. A little bit of a quote here from Barack Obama's inauguration speech. He addressed not just the American public, obviously, but he was addressing the whole world. This guy is seen as a world leader before he's done anything, which is good. And one of the reasons is because of his homogenized background and family. He's got everybody. He's got black, white, Jew, Gentile, Muslim. There's a rabbi in the family. Did you know that? A real mixture of cultures, religions, races, all mixed into the Obama family. And the fact that his father's side of the family in Kenya, is it Kenya? The whole thing is just amazing. It's just amazing. And so the world is listening to him. I saw a thing on one of the news programs, I forget which one, but they interviewed kids, very quick interviews, kids around the world about Barack Obama's presidency. And it was amazing, once again, amazing to hear these kids. It was very quick. It must have been on NBC or ABC or, one of these crappy-ass networks. But what the kids were saying, pretty much, I think all of them, was that they hoped that he would make things good, that he would bring peace. And like Molly said, the president helps people. So the world was listening to that speech. And I want to quote this for you. He said, quote, "Because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass, that the lines of tribe shall soon dissolve, that as the world grows smaller, our common humanity shall reveal itself, and that America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace." And then he also talked about what we're going to do with Iraq and Afghanistan. What he called a hard, he said he wanted a responsible withdrawal from Iraq and a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. Now, I think that's significant, hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. He didn't say victory. He wasn't spewing
chicken-ass macho crap that came out of Bush and Cheney's mouth all the time about, I'm going to hunt them down, we're going to find them, we're going to bring them to justice, we're going to win, victory, victory. Obama said regarding Afghanistan, hard-earned peace. Now, I said earlier tonight, I may be grasping at straws. I'll be real curious to see what President Obama does where it concerns Afghanistan. He's already declared that we're getting out of Iraq. But he called for a new era of responsibility, which was another kick in the shins of the freak sitting behind him when he gave this speech. He also said, quote, we will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you, end quote. And I wonder who he was addressing that to. We just saw the slaughter of innocents on a scale unprecedented in the Middle East by the Israeli Defense Forces against the unarmed population of Gaza. I'm not talking about the Hamas fighters. I'm talking about the people. And now that the IDF has pulled out, there is an assessment being made of the horrific damage and death and destruction. And the death toll continues to go up as they pull bodies of men, women, and children out of this bombed-out rubble. So who is Barack Obama addressing when he talks about for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and can't be broken. You can't outlast us and we'll defeat you. Do you wonder about that, or do you already know that he was talking only to, the Muslims? And his reference to the Muslim world is I don't know. When he talks about the Muslim world, according to Ali Abu Nima, who is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada webpage, and he's also the author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, but he said of those lines, quote, when he talks about the Muslim world, he is reinforcing the idea of conflict between the West, which he also mentioned, and, quote, the Muslim world, end quote. The real problem, which he did not address, is American and Israeli colonialism and occupation. The worst line was, quote, to those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West, know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you destroy. And Ali Abu Nima says, yes, Mr. Obama, people will and do judge your country by what it and Israel destroy. So always a two-edged sword, right? Junaid Ahmad, who is president of the U.S.-based National Muslim Law Students Association, said, quote, when Obama talks about those bad leaders, he's not talking about the vast majority of corrupt and dictatorial Muslim leaders that the U.S. supports, but the few that the U.S. is displeased by. And what he forgot to mention is that his respect for, quote, the rule of law, end quote, will not apply to, quote, the Muslim world, end quote, he wants to build new ties with, since he has plans to intensify illegal unilateral strikes on Pakistani territory as part of the larger surge in Afghanistan, continue to illegally threaten Iran with the use of force, and broadly support one Israeli illegal and criminal action after the other, end quote. Two points of view from two Arab speakers. Regarding Obama's comments. And where it concerns whether or not Obama will uphold his oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, Bruce Fine, who is the he was a Justice Department attorney in the Nixon administration, and author of the book Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy. Today, or yesterday, I should say, he and Ralph Nader sent a letter to Barack Obama. And when we come back here, I want to share that with you. And also, Michael Ratner, who is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, also, both Bruce Fein and Michael Ratner are addressing this issue of the war crimes committed by George Bush and certain members of his administration. So while Barack Obama is, I think he's attempting to assume the powers of the presidency of the United States, while at the same time, I do believe he's trying to be even-handed, but I think he understands the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I think he understands the refusal to acknowledge the territorial integrity of Pakistan, the chaos that's going on in Afghanistan. He's, like I said, he's a brilliant man. He understands all this stuff. How that squares with his political rhetoric right now is a curiosity to me, isn't it to you? And that's what I want to see from President Obama, how he sorts all this out.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
21 past the hour. So Bruce Fein, who worked in the Nixon, he was a Justice Department attorney in the Nixon administration, which you would think would immediately put his motives in the suspect column, but not necessarily so. He is also the author of the book Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, for Our Constitution and Democracy. Anyway, today or yesterday, he and Ralph Nader sent a letter to Barack Obama regarding the crimes, war crimes committed by Bush. This is what it said. Quote, the United States ratified the United Nations Convention Against Torture in 1994. Article 12 of that treaty provides, quote, each state party shall ensure that its competent authorities proceed to a prompt and impartial investigation wherever there is reasonable ground to believe that an act of torture has been committed in any territory under its jurisdiction, end quote. He goes on to say, he and Nader, former President George W. Bush and former Vice President Richard Cheney have both openly conceded that they authorized waterboarding on at least three al-Qaeda detainees. Among others, Attorney General Designate Eric Holder has characterized waterboarding as torture. The Federal Criminal Code punishes torture in accord with the treaty. The United States recently prosecuted and punished the son of Liberia's Charles Taylor for torture perpetrated in Liberia. The public record clearly gives reasonable ground to believe Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney, and their subordinates are implicated in torture. Article 12 of the Convention Against Torture thus requires that your administration conduct a, quote, prompt and partial investigation, end quote, of the individuals and their superiors involved in waterboarding the al-Qaeda detainees and in interrogating Mohammed al-Qahtani. We urge that the investigation be conducted by a special prosecutor with a Republican Party affiliation appointed by the Attorney General to forestall charges of partisanship. If no investigation is forthcoming, you will have violated Article 12. During your presidential campaign, you assailed the unilateralism of your predecessor, which flouted international obligations or responsibilities. You promised change. You should not ape former President Bush, by defying Article 12 of the Convention Against Torture. So the line in there, if no investigation is forthcoming, you will have violated Article 12. This is true because we are signatories of this treaty. And it says each state party shall ensure that its competent authorities proceed to a prompt and impartial investigation. Well, Barack Obama has that position now of competent authority. Michael Ratner, who's president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said today, quote, "The Bush years have been a nightmare, especially for those feeling the brunt of the administration's militaristic, inhuman, and illegal outrages. The law, legality, and separation of powers were of no account. For 8 years now, we have all suffered Bush's law. His actions were the law. It has echoes of the Führer's law of Nazi Germany. The wars and killings in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Gaza, the torture and detention of thousands held at prisons in Guantanamo, Iraq, Afghanistan, and secret sites, the implementation of a surveillance and spy state here at home with arrests on trumped-up terrorism charges, and the suppression of speech characterizing a terrible moment in all of our lives. The country, a country under Bush has moved well along on the road to a police state. The excitement of Obama's election can only take us so far. Bush's unconstitutional practices must be reversed. Constitutional rule must be reestablished. Constitutional rule means that those who grossly violated fundamental rights be prosecuted, that the torture team be brought to justice." So, oh, and then Michael Ratner lists seven actions that have to end: perpetual detention without trial, torture and inhumane treatment of detainees, trials in kangaroo courts such as the military commissions, offshore penal colonies and secret prisons, the rendition of people to other countries for torture, the surveillance state with its warrantless wiretapping, spying and suppression of speech, and rule by presidential fiat. That list of seven, that is it hard for you to understand? Because it is to me, for me, when I look at that list, to think that's what Bush has done. In the simplest language, he violated his oath, the oath that he took when he became president as a result of the thievery in both 2000 and 2004. He became a lawbreaker. So that's the other pivotal issue for me where it concerns Barack Obama. What is he going to do where it concerns the serious, murderous, vicious, violent crimes committed by his predecessor? We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
This is Laura Pigglesbush. When Georgie falls asleep, I creep into the Oval Office, sneak a ciggy, and turn on Mike Malloy. Then I reprogram Georgie's speed dial. The simple pleasures.
But Pickles, we don't care what you do anymore. And we don't care what your criminal husband does anymore. There's an executive order signed, is today the 21st, Kathy? Yeah, it is, isn't it? This was signed today by Barack Obama. This comes from the White House Office of the Press Secretary for Immediate Release, 21 January 2009. by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, and in order to establish policies and procedures governing the assertion of executive privilege by incumbent and former presidents in connection with the release of presidential records by the National Archives and Records Administration pursuant to the Presidential Records Act of 1978, it is hereby ordered as follows. Executive Order 13233 of November 1, 2001 is revoked. Now, if you remember what that was 2 months after the attack on this country. Bush and Cheney decided to hide everything they did prior to and subsequent to that attack. And to give them the cover of a nonpartisan effort, they also made unavailable to historians, the National Archives, or just common folk like you and me, Clinton's records, Pappy Bush's records, Reagan's records, and any future president's records. This is one of those issues 7 years ago that drove 8 years ago that drove some of us right over the edge. The Bush bastard decided that everything that he and Cheney did was to be secret and kept from the American public. And hence Executive Order 13233. And Barack Obama today revoked it, which has the effect, and this is retroactive, it doesn't just go forward, it also goes backwards. So the attempt to nullify the Presidential Records Act of 1978 by Bush, a successful attempt for 8 years, is, as of today, revoked. It's no longer the law. So that's one more little piece in this puzzle or mosaic, however you want to see it, of Barack Obama that so far to me is positive. And then there's this from Andy Barr at Politico.com, the new White House website that Obama's team unveiled yesterday includes a shot at former President Bush's response to Hurricane Katrina. If you go to the site under the agenda portion regarding Katrina, this is what it says, quote, President Obama will keep the broken promises made by President Bush to rebuild New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. He and Vice President Biden will take steps to ensure that the federal government will never again allow such catastrophic failures in emergency planning and response to occur, end quote. And the statement on the site then continues, quote, President Obama swiftly responded to Hurricane Katrina, citing the Bush administration's unconscionable ineptitude in responding to Hurricane Katrina. Then Senator Obama introduced legislation requiring disaster planners to take into account the specific needs of low-income hurricane victims, end quote. And you'll remember in those exit interviews, Bush defended his corrupt administration's response to the hurricane. During that interview with CNN last week, he said, quote, the truth of the matter is the response was pretty darn quick. If you think about the fact that the Coast Guard and a lot of brave kids were pulling 30,000 people off of roofs as soon as the storm passed, as soon as they found people on those roofs. Oh, God. And, you know, we talked about the Coast Guard operated strictly on its own. There was no order from the Home Office to do that at all. And as far as those kids are concerned, you know, Bush ought to understand something, that those kids are not kids at all. They are fully formed adults who are members of the United States Coast Guard and the United States Coast Guard Auxiliary. I don't think I have ever had such contempt for someone who had been president. Are we going to get any calls tonight? You want to try something? Anybody want to call in? The number is 800-989-1480. I know I've been rambling on and on here. Spitfire sent me something that's pretty interesting. Democrats have been described as being It's working with Democrats is like herding cats. The problem is that there has been infighting between various groups in the Democratic Party who had the mistaken notion that the best way to promote their cause is to claim it's more important than the other guy's cause in the Democratic Party. Thus, you have people trying to clear the air, fighting with people who want to, thus you have people trying to clean the air, fighting with people who want to clean the water, and people who want civil rights, fighting with people who want civil rights for black folk, fighting with people who want civil rights for Latinos. Then there's the ones who want better schools, fighting with those who want clean air and water or civil rights. And it's all done to provide great entertainment for the Republicans, who write all of these groups off as kooks when they're in power. The greatest fear of Republicans is that all of these groups within the Democratic Party will stop fighting and work together on a wide-ranging popular agenda. They have been undermining that effort for decades, and I noticed Obama kept talking about unity at each of the inaugural balls. I feel that he wasn't talking about getting along with the Republicans. But for Democrats to knock off the games and theater of attacking each other and to get along with each other, do you believe that's his intent? To some degree, Spitfire, but I also think that he's talking about blurring the lines between Democrats and Republicans, between liberals and conservatives. Now, you and I, and I think most people understand that that's going to be a very difficult, if not impossible, task. I hate Republicans, and I hate neoconservatives. They just turn my stomach. And, you know, good on Barack that he can make the gestures necessary, and Lord knows he's made them in the past month, of trying to knock down the barriers. But I guess Barack is going with that. Sun Tzu, the old saying, you know, hold your enemies close, or hold your friends close, hold your enemies closer. Maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe he fully understands that these people will cut his throat in an instant, no matter how many private dinner parties he goes to at their houses. They don't respect him. Certainly not his politics, and a lot of them, they don't respect him because of his racial mixture. They just don't. These are white Republican power brokers. They have no use for people who are not Republican. They certainly have no use for people who are not white Republicans. Come on, let's just cut the garbage here. That, you know, all of a sudden Republicans, because Barack Obama goes over to Charles Krauthammer's house for dinner, that these right wing pundits are going to all of a sudden say, well, okay, let's play nice. That's never going to happen. So I'm hoping that Obama completely understands this. Okay, phone calls. Let's start with Leah in Eureka, California, listening on KGOA. I think it's Leah. Leah, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, is it Leah?
Yeah.
Hi, Leah.
Oh, that was hilarious, the parody of Laura Bush earlier. My gosh.
Yeah, it is. Too bad it's so real. You know, I mean, those are the kinds of things that Laura Bush Pickles would say.
And so clever. Who wrote it?
Kathy.
Wow, I thought she might have. That is really commendable. Well, I was laughing all the way home.
I said before, she ought to go get a real job and get the hell away from this this program where she can get paid, you know. But anyway.
And she has such a sexy voice, too.
She does. But what you really called about.
Well, I had my first day in my history class today.
As a teacher or a student?
Student.
As a student, okay.
Yeah, and the professor brought up Andrew Johnson and his presidency and all the pardons that he was writing. He kind of characterized it as just a stack of papers, and he just sat back and wrote pardon after pardon after pardon, and it was really angering, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People who were opposed to him, you know, he was impeached. They couldn't impeach him because of that, but that was one of the reasons why people mm-hmm. wanted him impeached. And a few kids raised their hands and asked if that was what Bush was going to do.
If that's what Bush was going to do?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Issue pardon?
Oh, they were wondering how many people he was going to pardon, but then I heard earlier that, you know, a pardon from him would be like an admission, you know, of his guilt for the
apparently he's not going to pardon anybody. Leah, I got to leave it there. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
Turn on your nights when you turn off your light. Go to bed with Mike Malloy every night on Nova M Radio.
Ten before the hour. Thanks to Ian Huff, Ben Burt, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Bruce Enberg, and our executive producer, Kathy Bay. At Talking Points Memo, Josh Marshall just wrote, quote, after Chief Justice Roberts bungled the administering the president's oath of office, thus forcing the first presidential oath do-over in almost a century, I can see now that Republican incompetence is turning out to be the main theme of this administration, just like the last one. Michael is calling from Smithville, Virginia, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to, I'm just happy that the neocons are gone. That's good. And
yeah.
I grew up on the West Coast, but I live in the South now, and I talked to a person of color and today, and he grew up during the Civil Rights Movement, and I just had this amazing conversation with him, and, you know, he was just very emotional about watching the inauguration and seeing this happen, and something he just told me experiences of things that had happened to him as a kid and how he had to drive around white neighborhoods to get home and being, you know, chased by dogs and just different things that happened in his lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And it was just such an amazing conversation, and to see, like, you know, it's just such a, it's a pivotal switch now, and just, you know, I mean, I grew up, you know, with Clinton eras when I was young, and how, I mean, I just felt like Clinton was such a great president, and then to go through this for the last 8 years was just, I couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I've read all these books about neocons and all this crazy stuff that goes on with, you know, Republicans, and I don't know, it's just a great time. I think that, you know, hopefully things are going to change.
Well, I hope so, too. Michael, listen, thank you. I appreciate you checking. I want to move on here because I'm going to try to squeeze in a couple more calls. You know, regarding that issue, I don't think any white person, Michael, me, anybody, we, you know, can understand or feel the feelings. Of course we can't. That black folk in America felt on seeing the swearing in of President Barack Obama. And the odd part, too, is, you know, keep in mind, Barack Obama has a white parent and a black parent. But this is the United States. And in the United States, especially in every generation up to maybe the generation of people under 25 right now, and maybe you have to go lower. Maybe it has to be the generation under 10. But in every generation up to those, this country has always subscribed, because of our racist past, to the one-drop rule. And that is, simply put, somebody who had a grandparent, perhaps, who happened to be of African descent, is considered African-American, period. I mean, it's just, it's been crazy, but it's been the fallout from the slavery and the denial of humanity, much less citizenship or voting rights or equal rights or sitting at a damn lunch counter to black folks. So, you know, no white people can get this. No white people can understand this. Not one of us can get this. We can appreciate it from a standpoint of being part of the racist majority and not liking that. I mean, there are millions of whites, as evidenced by the voting patterns. Millions of whites who felt that way. fully aware of the appearance of Barack Obama, fully aware of their own racism, whether it was deeply embedded or right up on the surface. But for once, an awful lot of Americans, I think, voted their best interests. They looked past something as pedestrian as race and saw somebody who was going to provide something that this country either had to get or collapse. That's all. Can you imagine right now if we were in day two of the John McCain, Sarah Palin administration? Jesus Christ, don't say that to me, Malloy, this late at night. I'll have nightmares. But can you imagine? No, neither can I. So a lot of white people in this country of various ages who have had racism as part of their DNA. I mean, come on. Be honest, white folks. Racism is part of our genetic makeup. It's been there. It's been there for 230 years, 300 years, 400 years. It's been there. And a round of applause, and I mean this, to all the white people who were able to transcend that. Really. And there were lots of reasons for that. But none of us whites can ever fully understand or emotionally appreciate or feel that deep, deep empathy with black folk where it concerned the election and swearing in of Barack Obama. We just can't do it any more than we can feel anything for a group of people that was suppressed or oppressed or murdered or sent to death camps. And then we find out about it or we witness it. And it wasn't us. You know, it was them. It wasn't us. And the us can never fully appreciate the them. It's impossible. It can't be done. So, I certainly appreciate Michael's point of view. It's pretty much mine. You know, after having grown up in this kind of a country and this kind of a racist society as I have, and fully experienced racism, absolutely fully, as the racist, not as the racy, but as the racist, me, to see the election of Barack Obama on no other basis, just on race. You know, I'm just throw everything else out, just on that one issue. It was powerful and moving and a relief. That's all. I'll see you tomorrow night, True Seekers. Take care. Do take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.